Welcome to the podcast, The Caring Scientist, Mission Sustainable. This is the podcast where we discuss sustainability in science and we give you hands-on tips on how you can reduce the environmental impact of your lab work.
Welcome to this episode of our podcast. My name is Adriana.
And I'm Nicoline.
And today we're going to talk about air travel in academia. And for this purpose, we're talking to Tern Buscema and Kate Whitfield from the Thoughtful Travel Campaign. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
So let's start with Kate. Could you introduce yourself, where you're located, and what's your profession?
So my name's Kate Whitfield. I work at the Barcelona Institute for Global Health. I'm actually based in Japan. And I've just made a career change specializing in sustainability.
Wonderful.
And Tern, could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
My name is Tern Buscema. I'm a malaria researcher based at Radboud University Medical Center in Nijmegen, the Netherlands. And in my free time, I also try to work on sustainability in academia.
That's really great. So you two have reached out to us with a thoughtful travel campaign. Could you explain a little bit what the campaign is about? And first of all, what was your motivation to start it?
Yeah, so the Thoughtful Travel Campaign is dealing with just a very complicated topic, I think, in academia, that we all like to do something about sustainability. But as long as it's solar panels on roofs or beehives, it's absolutely fine and everyone loves it. As soon as we talk about travel, people say, don't go there because it's just so ingrained in academia, and we like to travel and we need to travel, that it's really difficult. It's almost a no-go zone. At the same time, we know it is a really important source of emissions. So that is why we thought about the Thoughtful Travel Campaign. And there's been other initiatives, but this is just a way to do a few things. One of them is pledge as researchers to take our own responsibility and travel less. But the other is really advocating systemic change, because it's not going to be only bottom-up initiatives. Something really has to change about our travel behavior in academia.
So, Kate, if you could tell us a bit about your motivation to take part in the Thoughtful Travel Campaign.
Sure, thank you. So I joined in this effort partly because I've been involved in revising our own institutional travel policy. As we're all aware of, the lack of travel and the travel restrictions during the pandemic have taught us some important lessons, and rethinking how we travel in the academic sector seems to be a very timely topic.
For sure.
To just say something on top of that, in 2019, just before the COVID pandemic, there were a few instances, also one personal, where I asked a conference organizer whether they could offer a virtual option, just because I said I want to skip every few conferences for sustainability reasons. And they said it's practically impossible. We can't organize that. And a colleague of mine who's a neuroscientist, he had the same problem with Iranian researchers who couldn't travel to the US because of the travel restrictions. He asked the conference organizer, can we please have a virtual option for these colleagues? And they said, well, it's impossible to organize that. And that's only 2 years ago. So I think so much has happened since then. It's very timely to think about how we deal with conferences in the future, but also other reasons to travel.
It's a super interesting point that what we thought was practically impossible now is for sure doable. Now it's more a question of actually doing it and feeling good about it and not feeling we're compromising research and our work. The reason why we're even discussing air travel in academia is because it's significant. It's not a drop in the water. It's not trivial. It actually makes up a huge proportion of the total carbon footprint of the science we do. I'm wondering, do you have any data that you can share with us on this matter?
Last year, there was a piece in the journal Nature where they estimated the total number of researchers worldwide as more than 7 million, 7.8 million, I believe, and then estimated if only people would attend one or two conferences, and we know we do, what would be the total carbon footprint of academic conferencing? And that already exceeds the country of Iceland and also the country of Uganda, just academic conferencing. So we cannot say it's a trivial contribution. It's actually the size of countries. I started working on it for a conference that both Kate and I often attended, the American Society for Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. The same conference organizers who said it's impossible, virtual options. And we calculated the total travel distance and carbon emissions for one conference. And that is for medical conference, it's a medium-sized conference, 4,800 participants. But together, they travel 45 million kilometers each conference.
So one of the messages that really struck me from this study was the total number of trips equivalent to the moon and back. So for this one conference of about 4,000 people, all traveling to one single destination in the US, with the equivalent to 58 trips to the moon and back.
That is an incredibly high number. That's truly mind-blowing.
And of course, I was part of that. And it just felt so extremely excessive for a great number of people to be jet lagged in one space for a week. As we've learned, it doesn't have to be like that. We can successfully connect, share. You know, scientists still have that spirit of sharing their new findings, emerging data, even before publication through virtual platforms. This is a great lesson learned, and we need to reflect on and sustain some of these good practices for the sake of the climate.
There has been an initiative of the Young Academy in the Netherlands, where they try to estimate what proportion of the total carbon emissions of universities is associated to air travel. And for some institutions like Erasmus University in Rotterdam, it was approaching 25% of total carbon emissions. So that's for institutions, but also at a local level. So I gathered all the travel receipts of my department and also of one other department in my university medical center. And with these two departments, and they're not huge departments, every year we make 2.5 million kilometers in air travel.
Holy guacamole.
And of course, it's completely heterogeneous. So it's not that all staff members make the same distance. But 2.5 million kilometers every year for two medium-sized departments is really considerable.
And when you say medium-sized, how many people in total does this number cover, sort of?
For my department, if you talk about staff members and researchers, it's only probably about 30. And there are some other people who may also travel, but these are like the medical specialists and the assistant professors, associate professors. So that's not a huge department. And I must say, I have had years in the past where I had this gold card from KLM, and I even know of colleagues, and I think many people will recognize that, who even say, I'm working on my miles, so I'm just almost there to keep my gold status or to get my gold status or platinum, which I think, frankly, is just a very embarrassing practice.
I mean, with today's eyes, it is, at least for some people. Hopefully, this will be flipped. So it's like, I only did this many miles this year. I mean, that's what we're aiming for, right? That now we're not bragging about how many conferences we fly to, how often we go somewhere, but how little we fly and how much we're attending virtual conferences or planning them.
I completely agree. And I think that's one of the things that we should be proud of. It should be the bottom line of a lot of things we do in research. Done sustainably, or some kind of tagline where you say, we've done this, great science, and done sustainably. But it is still lacking, and I still really fear that we go back to the old way of traveling. And also from outside academia, just in the commercial world, there's now a lot less flying, but most large organizations, they still expect that within a few years, we may reduce it a little bit, but we will go back to considerable travel.
So this brings us to the question now, can we actually in academia do without air travel?
Or can we do with at least fewer air travels? And how do we do that?
Exactly. So what would you say from your standpoint? So virtual meetings and conferences, what are the benefits besides obviously the environmental impact?
Yeah, so I think there are multiple advantages to online connections and virtual connections. So one of them is, you know, if you're a busy clinician or you've got other work commitments where you really can't leave the bench or your hospital, you can, of course, connect remotely. So that's one. If you don't have travel budget, you've suddenly been able to connect to these big conferences and present your work, which perhaps you wouldn't have been able to do before. And there's a big equity element to that when you think about low and middle income countries and also more junior scientists. And then reflecting on another element, you know, people have different domestic situations, and this has been a personal situation for me. I have a young daughter, and, you know, it's really disruptive if you need to do a long haul journey, stay away from home for a long time, and all of that's been averted, and happily staying at home but doing the work.
One thing I heard that I didn't realize, but it relates to the equity, is that I work in tropical medicine, and often there's a lot of travel also from Europe to Africa, for instance, to organize research. And I've heard from colleagues that actually the last year has really allowed local research, sometimes also junior researchers, to take much more of a lead. And things just continued very happily and also very productively. So the idea that we need to travel a lot, and especially those short trips to just discuss protocols and get people started, it's sometimes a bit patronizing to people who actually do the work locally. So that's something I heard from colleagues in Africa, that they see that as a major advantage.
The headline here is really inclusivity, right, and equity. I think that's really wonderful. And when we speak about sustainability, I mean, sometimes we get lost in the green part of sustainability, but in reality, what we need is social equity and green sustainability.
I agree. And I think there's plenty of advantages to virtual meetings if you invest in them. Because I think sitting behind a computer and expecting a Zoom call to be as lively and as pleasant as an in-person meeting is just not real. But we had a retreat recently of my institution in London, where there was a serious investment in getting really good quality virtual contributions. So there were multiple cameras. And there was a group in Uganda and a group in the Gambia who were joining. They had pre-recorded sessions, but they also had a good group, a good place with a good camera and a good microphone to contribute. And that worked extremely well. So I think that's something that we also have to realize. It's been a very steep learning curve the last year and a half, and things are really improving very rapidly. And we just have to embrace it and continue doing it. At the same time, I think we also shouldn't feel that it all has to be as good or as pleasant as it is in person. And one of the examples there, and also worked on some calculations for a large European research funder, prestigious personal grants, and they had a process of flying in candidates and also panel members for interviews. And every year they made 14 million kilometers just for these panel meetings, including, and that's where I think it really feels absurd, flying in candidates for a 10-minute pitch and 20-minute interview. And that element, just that pitch, already contributed to 4 million travel kilometers every year, which is something that is ridiculous. It's so disruptive. People traveling sometimes all the way from Australia to Brussels for a 30-minute interview. We really can do without that. At the same time, the panel member said, I don't enjoy it as much as the old meetings. But I think that we should really get away from feeling that it should be as enjoyable or there should not be a personal sacrifice. I think for some things, I personally really feel we should say this is no longer acceptable. And even if it's less pleasant, how do we make the most of it? How do we make it least unpleasant or most productive?
And that's also an interesting point, right? The pleasant versus productive, because what are we actually doing it for? Of course, it should also be fun to go to work. We should have a lot of social interactions and those things. But the real impact from a conference should hopefully be, it should be related to work. Then there's the fun, that's a bonus. But maybe accepting that, you know, what we really want with the conference is this we can actually also achieve online.
You know, I think there are many perks to traveling. And certainly when many of us used to travel to these big conferences, we all kind of commented that it was a circus and you were too busy to actually sit and enjoy the scientific sessions and the symposia. And actually what we were all really there for was the networking, having your side meetings with your collaborators and your funders, and if you were lucky, getting taken out for dinner by your funder, right? These were really what you were there to do. And I think in addition to innovation and having sort of better cameras and better video and all of this, when you host meetings, I think it's worth investing in maybe one-on-one interactions or special sessions that you wouldn't otherwise have. Like, for example, special sessions or e-panels with editors or funders, so that you feel that you're not just observing or receiving presentations from colleagues, but there's like these extra bonuses that were very meaningful in person that could also be structured and meaningful online.
I think you both touched upon a really important point that we shouldn't just settle with regular Zoom meetings here. That's not what we're aiming for. We're aiming for getting the best out of the technological options that there are to get the most out of it. Now, I'm curious to hear, because those are like related to if you would organize something, this is what you could do, this is what you could explore or try to find. But generally actions, like what can we actually do as researchers, as parts of institutions, what can institutions do, what can funding bodies do? Do you have any specific advice for people listening in?
So this is exactly what we tried to tackle in my institution in IS Global. And we started a process of revising our travel policy. We tried to make it inclusive and consultative, including with people that travel a lot. I think that's quite important. So I think at the institutional level, you know, people can start these conversations with the overarching goal of reducing emissions from our work travel. And then how you actually go about doing that in your institution will have to be very context specific. So I think an institutional travel policy from a university based in the middle of Europe, very well connected by trains, might look quite different to where I'm sitting on an island in, you know, just off Japan. So very context specific and essentially about thinking how low carbon options can be prioritized. What meetings, interviews, committee meetings, etc., can you host online as a default now and not having in-person as the default? And then using green nudges, so this concept of behavioral science, to make it easy for people. So having your booking system generate the train itineraries before the flights, and maybe internal tracking where people can actually see how they're doing either against their own personal average or their own personal track record or the average overall. You know, are they flying more or less? And somehow acknowledging and rewarding those kind of behaviors. So this is all under the kind of green nudges behavioral science umbrella.
Very nice.
Yeah, so at my institution, we're also in the middle of revising the travel policy, making it more attractive and at some point probably enforcing train travel if it's possible. And also really advocating that we want to reduce our travel. And I think that's something that personally I was always a little bit embarrassed to say I want to travel a bit less. It was not too sexy to say I skip one every three conferences because I'm worried about the planet. But I think we do have to speak up and say, I'm doing this, and then try to avoid making it sound very woolly or very unattractive. So I think we should just present this as common sense. There's no need for it. It's unacceptable. But then at the same time, the bottom-up initiatives, I think we should really foster them and we should stimulate bottom-up initiatives. And that's also the Thoughtful Travel Pledge. At some point, it has to be top-down. And I think I am impressed by some of our colleagues from the astronomy field who started Astronomers for Planet Earth some years ago. And they had an open letter to all the institutions signed by more than 3,000 astronomers saying we demand that we change our behavior and we put sustainability as the top priority. It's not something that it's nice. No, sustainability is really a top priority. And I think that is really needed. And at some point, also the directors of institutions have to say, and now we really want to be a leader and we want to reduce our travel by 25% compared to 2018. And perhaps after a while, we add another 10%. So that's for institutions. We also have to think about who pays the bill in the end of all this travel. So it's the funders and it's way the taxpayer who pays for a lot of the travel. So one of the initiatives that Kate and I are also involved in is approaching funders, asking them to include a sustainability paragraph in all the funding applications But also just say, we are going to question you if you ask for 30,000 euros every year in travel budget. Do you still need it? Why do you need that much? And in the end, they, of course, pay the bill. So they also have a lot of power. So we have a paper coming out in a medical journal. This academic publication is just a first step. We're really going to approach different funders, say, respond to it. And we will organize a virtual symposium, and the different funders have to explain why they think this is relevant or why they think this is irrelevant. And at some point, I'm convinced that they will be embarrassed to say, we don't have an opinion about carbon, which I heard from one of the funders. We don't have an opinion about carbon. It's not an opinion. It's just, it's a fact. You have to do something about it. I think that is going to change. And I think we can play a small role in just accelerating that change.
I think it's a really interesting point, both with the institutional level and the funding bodies, that in the end, like, there's a lot you can do from bottom up, right? Because in an institution, the management doesn't want to be too unpopular, right? First of all, because that creates a horrible atmosphere and mistrust in these things, but also the researchers getting the most funding, they can in principle just take their money and leave, and they don't want that to happen, right? And in the funding bodies, at least some of them are covering their lack of climate ambitions up with, like, we're member driven. We need the members to want this before we make a strategic move, right? And this basically means that whatever anyone can do is helping the bigger picture and the structural changes, right?
Yeah, I think that cultural shift that we're looking for is really going to come about when we have the combination of the push and the pull. So I saw this happening in our specific example at IS Global. So there was an internal push from staff and researchers and students that we wanted to operate in a more sustainable way. And we started revising our travel policy. And at the same time, we had a really important pull from an external funder. So there are some funders, taking the lead in this area of greener travel. And for us, the important one was the Wellcome Trust. So the Wellcome Trust, I think since 2020 or 2019, they actually require staff and grantees to adopt a thoughtful travel approach. So you should prioritize low carbon travel, including virtual options. And actually, the Wellcome Trust will also pay for offsetting if traveling by plane is absolutely essential. So as soon as you have a funder, making that an eligibility requirement for any grant application, institutions really take notice, and that accelerated our thoughtful travel policy revisions at IS Global. It was quite transformative. So we need to see this at scale. And there are other examples of funders doing this now. So the Marie Sklodowska-Curie Actions, they actually have come out with a green charter earlier this year, and they fund a lot of mobility in science. So they fund a lot of sort of research exchanges. But again, they don't want to do this at the expense of the planet. So sustainability and thinking about prioritizing low carbon, low emission travel is in their green charter for grantees as well.
That's wonderful to hear. That gives me some hope.
This reminds me of not a policy, but just a coincidence that because of COVID-19, we had less travel, and we actually had a grant with a large travel budget. And then the funder, the Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, said, we propose that you use this travel money that you're not going to touch anyway to pay for your local researchers, in our case, mostly in Burkina Faso, to attend conferences. And that was just, let's do something useful with the money. But it also made me think we are, in a way, not using the research funding in a very thought through way. We can do a lot more than just spending it on sometimes business class plane tickets.
Yeah, we can actually get more research for the money if we consider how we travel in academia. That's a really good point.
There was also an editorial that came out last month in all the major medical journals saying that we have to do a lot more and a lot faster to mitigate climate change. And I was talking to one of the editors of BMJ yesterday over a coffee and just asked him, how much pushback did you get? And he said there was actually a lot of pushback, especially from senior people who thought it was not the role of clinicians or of researchers to ask the government to enforce certain policy or And we talked a lot about what do you do with this pushback. And he basically said, don't worry too much about the older generation because they struggle with Zoom. They don't know how to unmute. But really focus on the younger generation, because although you can imagine they want to travel and they feel they need it for their academic career, they're actually a lot more positive about reducing their travel and embracing alternatives to frequent travel. And I think it's important to say we're not against travel. We're just thinking about what is useful travel and how do you make the most of your travel.
Hence the name Thoughtful Travel Campaign, right? It's not banning travel from academia.
Some flying is going to be necessary depending on where you live, what you're connected to, and what your role entails. But it's just about trying to limit, be really selective about the flying you do and prioritizing low carbon forms of travel.
I think it's a really interesting point in terms of inclusivity that doing a lot of things virtually or online might exclude an older generation. They have had a lot of benefits in their entire lives, but right now they might actually be struggling with exactly what you're saying, to mute, unmute, and tune into the right link. So maybe there's also like a little challenge for all of us here to really try to help whoever is struggling with Zoom or virtual things, because this will also make the barrier smaller, hopefully, for using these tools. I'm thinking, what are the things that the listeners can do? First of all, it's maybe about starting bottom-up initiatives, signing your pledge, communicating about air travel in academia, like simply taking the conversation over lunch or wherever. Like, could we do mobility in academia differently? Do you have any other tips for the listeners? How do you speak about traveling less, for example, without meeting a lot of resistance?
Yeah, so I think if you do have a focal person in a funding agency that you can talk to, have a conversation with them about it. I'm sure that they are also thinking about it. You know, how do they reallocate all of this travel funding that they used to fund grantees to do? And how do we do this better? I think it's something we're all thinking about. And ask them, you know, to value real sustainability efforts from grantee institutions. And there are some good examples to follow, like the UK Research and Innovation, the Wellcome Trust, and the Marie Sklodowska-Curie Actions are all good examples. We've done one very, very small thing at IS Global, but I think it's quite fun and positive. So now when we do present at virtual meetings, we have the option just to have a thank you slide at the end, thanking the organisers for giving us the opportunity to present and participate virtually. So it's a little bit of a social signalling strategy, but tries to indicate that it's not just, you know, an individual choice, but it's about the conference organizers also making it possible. And that's quite nice, I think.
That's a good point.
One of the things I realized is that you have a lot more influence than you think. I never thought I had impact on funders, but then I was somewhere with a funder and said, can I calculate your carbon footprint? I was a bit aggressive in making sure they gave me the data. But in the end, we had a few meetings with the funder to talk about their carbon footprint. For some people, this is an unpopular message, flying less. But think about in your institutions, who are the people who are well respected and who are very visible? And do you have allies there? And if you can find people who you don't immediately associate with sustainability efforts, I've sometimes been called an eco-fascist. So you don't want to have those people who are really known for being quite aggressive. But if you have people who are influencers at your local institution who can make traveling less in a way sexy or just make it common sense, then I think that can really help. And at some point, have the courage to go high up and go to your board of directors and say, there's been all these bottom-up initiatives. What are you going to do top-down to accelerate it?
Wonderful advice. Hopefully everyone can make a little difference simply by doing some of the things that we spoke about now. Yeah, so how can people learn more about your campaign?
So you go to flyingless.org and there you will find an animation that we made, how ridiculous academic travel can sometimes be. And there's also a possibility to sign a pledge and also look who else signed the pledge. So who are your local or international friends?
Wonderful. We're going to put the links in the show notes so people can also find it there. Thank you so much, Kate and Tern, for tuning in today. It was really, really interesting to speak with you, and we hope all the best for your campaign, and we're for sure going to advocate for it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. You're my favorite podcast.
Nice, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to get in touch, please feel free to email us at podcast@avasustain.com. That is podcast@avasustain.com. We have also put this email address and other useful links in the notes below this podcast. Till next time.